and welcome to Talking Aussie Books, a weekly podcast bringing readers and writers of Australian fiction together. I'm Claudine Tennellis. As an avid reader and passionate advocate for Australian fiction, I make it my mission to spotlight local talent. So if you're looking for your next read or simply want to learn more about the Australian literary scene, this podcast is for you. Grab yourself a cuppa, sit back and relax. I first interviewed my next guest author back in April of 2020 when she self-published her first novel, Vivaldi's Last Concerto. I remember thinking back then that Vivaldi's Last Concerto was a book that deserved to have a broad audience. Such was the depth of research and detail that coloured the historical thread, along with the harrowing experiences of a contemporary woman who had been through the prison system. Well, this year that author, Jennifer Mackenzie Dunbar, is back with a new novel, a story that she in fact foreshadowed to me the last time we chatted. Called Missing Pieces, it's a novel that bears Jennifer's trademark fascination with real historical events. This time, we learn about the discovery of a priceless hoard of medieval handcrafted chess pieces on the remote Scottish island of Lewis in 1831, through the prism of stories by fictional women involved in their creation, concealment, loss, and subsequent discovery. A truly remarkable tale, and one that I'm delighted to have the chance to speak with Jennifer about on the podcast today. So welcome back, Jen.
Been a while. Did lots of water under the bridge since we last spoke, but here we are. Fantastic. Thanks.
Here we are indeed. So first off, I wanted to say congratulations. What a marvellous achievement.
Thank you. Yes, sometimes you get caught up in the doing and getting things done and forget, you know, what a journey it's been, and this is actually kind of the end of a huge journey. So thanks, it's been wonderful.
Yeah. So Jen, this is your first traditionally published book, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So how did the experience of going through a traditional publisher differ from your indie journey, do you think?
Yeah. Look, it's been great to know that there are a team of specialists behind what you're doing, you know, getting behind what you do. So and Midnight Sun Publishing have been fantastic. You know, lots of different, you know, people doing different roles, of course. So from Anna Solding, who's the owner and manager of the company, to Phoebe, who kind of recognised the value in my book and pulled it out of the slush pile and gave it another read, right through, and I won't do all the names, but right through to the proofreaders at the end. And of course, my lovely Kim Locke, the designer of my wonderful cover, deserves a special mention as well. So have that team behind you is both a little bit daunting, I've got to say, but also really affirming of who you are as a writer. So that's, yeah, it's been really great. I've got to, you know, and I'll probably attest to this, I've not struggled, but it's been a challenge for me to let go of the reins, because when you're self-publishing, you have control of everything and the timelines, and you know exactly what you're going to do when. So a lesson for me to go, okay, trust your team and go on with it. Both good experiences, but I'm really enjoying the trad publishing.
Yeah, special mention for that cover. It's wonderful. And absolutely. I love the way that one of the chess pieces has been reproduced on the cover.
Indeed.
Jen, did the book change much from submission through to final publication?
No, actually, not a lot. I had it already structurally edited while it was kind of sitting with Midnight Sun, because I kind of thought, oh, well, it looks like I'm going to self-publishing again. So I had it by History Quill in the UK, the fantastic mob. So her feedback drew me into quite a fairly significant rewrites of the modern character, not much at all historics. So I'd done that already. So the part, by the time it got to Phoebe doing the structural edit, not a great deal then changed, just some tweaking and, you know, bringing things forward, changing things, you know, clarifying a few things, etc. So, yes, so that part of it wasn't too arduous. Yeah.
Fantastic. So, Jen, tell me how you're feeling about its impending release.
Really excited. I just said to you before we went on air, like, so easy to get caught up in the doing of things, to not sit back and take a breath and go, this is a really good process. So this is a really good place to be and just enjoy the moment, I guess. So hopefully by Sunday, when I'm really doing that, that'll be where we're at. We've got a fantastic turnout for the launch, about 180 people booked in, which is amazing. A few champagnes and a chat with a friend, the launch, some signings, etc. So, and to know that I'm in amongst a crowd of Australian writers who, you know, really coming to the forefront, I think, of writing across many genres. So that's been fantastic too.
Yeah, wonderful. So, Jen, where did the inspiration for this book come from? I remember talking about it when we last chatted on the podcast, but I wondered what started you thinking about writing a story around the discovery of the Lewis Chessmen?
I actually bought a replica copy, a replica of the chess pieces. I guess it was when I was 20, 21, when I was first in Scotland. To be honest, I can't actually remember where I bought them from, but I've had them and they've gone in and out of the box according to how many children and grandchildren are around. They're now permanently on top of my piano. So I've had them, and when I bought that, there was just a, you know, typewritten sheet around the discovery and some of the things that were known about them. So I knew a little bit about the mysterious discovery in a sandhill, so that was intriguing enough. But the trigger for the book came from reading Nancy Marie Brown's Ivory Vikings book, really, and the fact that maybe, possibly, even probably, they were carved by a woman in Iceland. Well, that just, you know, I thought, here we go. This is perfect for my style of writing and the things I would like to write about. So that really triggered me into going, yeah, there's a real story here. There's a mystery. There's women. There's beautiful artifacts. Who can resist?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I confess that I went online to have a really good look at some of the pieces that are held in the British Museum. And on my next trip there, I'm going to the UK in September. I'm definitely going to go and make sure that I visit them. They're quite astonishing to look at, aren't they?
Very unusual. I love them, of course. A close friend of mine said when she first saw them, she thought, oh, they're quite ugly. But she's learned to love them, she said, because of that character kind of, we look at them through our 21st century eyes as caricatures, but I think really they fitted with the way things were done back then. But I can't help but think there is humour in them as well. There's that real mixture of them being beautiful, but also very human. Yeah, I definitely love them.
Yeah, I mean, the detail, the style, and the fact that they were made from walrus tusks. Yes, incredible.
Yes, indeed, indeed. And that's part of the reason a lot of the walrus tusks had to come from Greenland. And the fact that they look so beautiful after so long, and the skill in that carving to get all those curves and intricacies is, again, part of the intrigue for me.
So, Jen, can you tell us a little bit more about your story?
Sure. Based on this real story, of course, the real mystery of how these beautiful artifacts came to be buried in a sandhill. And even there's a mystery around how they got from the remoteness of Lewis down to the British Museum is somewhat of a mystery. The story is carried by four women, three historic women and one contemporary. The story of the contemporary character carries the plot, if you like. So Marianne is an archaeologist working at the British Museum, but she's working in a job as a lab technician, which is well below her skill level and her qualifications. And the biggest reason for that is she's still suffering a huge amount of depression and despondency about the sudden death of her father by a hit and run accident. The story kind of opens with her going to a meeting at the British Museum and finding out, or suspecting very seriously, that her boss, who she has quite an antagonistic relationship with, George, has probably plagiarised her master's thesis. And she's thrown into, you know, a whirlwind of, you know, of despair and frustration around that, and does try to confront him. But when she does, he actually kind of has a very strong but veiled threat around her job. So Marianne's not in a great place. And then he tells her he's sending her to the Isle of Lewis to accompany 12 of the chess pieces to an exhibition up there. That, again, is another layer of frustration for Marianne, because she doesn't actually like being out of London too much. She's got a very comfortable, cozy life there, and she likes that security. So it really does nudge her out of her comfort zone. So the story follows her up to Scotland. She takes her mother with her, and they too have a very fractious relationship. And that actually goes back to a time when Marianne was 16 and things happened in her life which she still hasn't really faced or confronted. So the two women go up to the Isle of Lewis, and as soon as they're there, Marianne begins to experience life a little differently. Things happen to her that both in very practical ways. The kindness of people there begins to impact on her, but also there are some otherworldly things that seem to be happening around her. And there's a bit of a mixture of reality and this touch of sprinkle of what Kate Forsyth would call a sprinkle of magic there. So while she's there, some of this magic leads her into both confronting some of the things she needs to confront in her own life and talk about, but also to find the missing 49 pieces. There are actually 49 pieces of the, well, there were, and I'll come back to that, missing. And she's challenged in a very unusual way to perhaps go and find out where these 49 pieces are. So that's her story. And as she does that, the reader is taken back into the lives of three other women who were impacted on the carving of the chessmen. So there's Margrét the Adroit, Icelandic carver. She is a real person. And she has her own battles with the bishop who has commissioned the chess pieces. There is Morvan, who is a Scottish woman in the 11th, 12th century, who has the gift of the second sight, her calling, and through her calling, she discovers both a brake full of the chess pieces on the beach after a huge storm, and also a shipwrecked sailor. And her story is about her way of relating to that sailor that changes her life as well. And then the third historic person is Marie MacLeod, married to Malcolm or Callum MacLeod. And it was Callum who reportedly did find the chess pieces back in 1831. Marie and Callum are living sort of at the very start of what became known as the clearances in Scotland. The lands are being taken back by the absent landlords, even though they've been held by the families and farmed by the families for years, that they're displaced off of their lands to make way for sheep, who are much more profitable than having crofters. And many people are being shipped off to Canada. And Marie, finding the chess pieces, uses all of her wit and negotiation skills to try to stave off the impact of the devastation of the clearances.
An absolutely fascinating story. Now, I was just reflecting on what you were talking about, and in fact, the story does start off in the year 1190 in Iceland, and you imagine the creator of the chess pieces to be this woman named Margrét. And as you said, she was a real person. So I wondered if you could take us through your reasoning and process for imagining their creation story this way.
Question. Well, I guess reading Nancy Marie Brown's book kind of helped feed that into me. I don't know. I'm just trying to think. I visualised this woman and, you know, what would life have been like for a woman back in those? I mean, one of the things we do know is that Icelandic women were and still are quite highly valued. You know, they've had a different position in society than many Western women have, or other Western women, I guess you would say. But to think that, you know, somebody was such a highly skilled craftsperson and valued, like, I just kind of wondered how you would get to be that. So I had to put my imagination to work and make all those. For some reason, I just imagined her as a cripple born with a club foot. That was not a real thing. And I just began to look at how women overcome difficulties to create a place for themselves in the world.
So, Jen, what kind of research did you have to do?
Lots of reading. I've got lots of different books, and some of those are mentioned in the back of the novel, just to get a sense of all the different locations and, you know, at the time that I'm writing about, because of course they change over all time. I use maps a lot. I try to get hold of old maps. I've definitely got an old map of Scotland and what different place names were at the time. But of course, I actually went to Lewis. That was an amazing and important thing to do, I think, to get a real sense of the place. And so even though obviously things have changed since 1831, even when they were found, it's still a very remote place. There's not a lot. It hasn't grown much in population. In fact, in many ways, probably population's gone down. It's because a lot of the houses there now are holiday houses, so there's not the permanent people there anymore. So, but just to visit the beaches, to hear the Atlantic sort of roaring and crashing on the beach, that was a really important part of all of that for me. music plays a big part in my life, and I listen to the music of the time, and you know, a lot of Gaelic music, which obviously I don't speak or understand, but it conveys a atmosphere that I tried to capture within the novel.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, you mentioned that you first encountered the chess pieces when you were, you know, in your 20s.
Yeah.
But I wondered how long this story was percolating in your mind before you decided to start writing it.
I really could say not at all until I read Nancy's book. That it just popped out, you know, I guess I'd finished Vivaldi's Lost Concerto and I was looking for something else to write about. Like the Morven character, the one with the second sight, I'd actually written a short story, a contemporary short story of a woman with a second sight. So that story actually, yes, had been with me for some time. So I wove that in to the novel, but really it was the reading of Nancy's book that really pushed it forward. It might have been there in the back of my brain, of course, but it came forward.
Indeed. Now, one of the fascinating threads of this story is the concept of ownership of artifacts like the Lewis chessmen.
Absolutely.
It's something that Marianne has to address when she goes to Lewis in the contemporary timeline. There's some discussion around whether artifacts should be returned to the country in which they are found instead of being exhibited elsewhere. It's called the repatriation of culturally significant museum collection items. I wonder, Jen, is this an actual debate going on in relation to the Lewis chessmen?
It really came up as when they went to referendum for independence. I can't remember the date, but not too long ago. Mm-hmm. So it kind of became the, you know, one of the things that they identified as being a symbol of that independence and a symbol of where things had gone wrong. So definitely that. And of course, you know, people have watched Mark Fennell's SBS program recently, Things the British Stole. That, again, you know, all over the world, people are looking at, and it's not just the British, I guess, it was the whole, all of the colonisation processes. Artifacts were taken, sometimes bought or legitimately given, but often taken. And so there is a huge debate around that. And in Australia, of course, with the Australian Aboriginal people, many artifacts are lying, even in our own museums, unexhibited, without any real knowledge of where they came from, but also horrendously human remains. I just talked to a friend on the weekend on a reconciliation walk, and her husband's involved with the museum here. And yes, that is a big piece of work that is being done by museums. And I was lucky enough actually recently to be the messenger or the conveyor of a Australian boomerang that was carved at least in 1909. It became into my friend's family in 1909. And I've given that back to the people from the area where it probably came from. But there is a whole discussion happening around whether that actually should be in a museum and being preserved under the museum conditions, or does it belong with the family and the people of that land. So yeah, huge debate going on at the moment.
Yeah, I was really fascinated with the way Marianne actually dealt with that question when she was asked specifically. I think there was a journalist that had asked her that question, but she was in Lewis at the time. And I think Marianne's answer was, for her, it was more important that people had access to the artifacts. She was more concerned about that than she was concerned about ownership or repatriation of those things. Well, what do you think about that?
I probably didn't say earlier, I did actually see the Lewis chessmen in the British Museum before I actually bought them. So I would never have known about them had I not seen them in the British Museum. So yeah, there's a big argument for them being in central and well-accessed museums, I think. But I can definitely understand the people of Lewis and Scotland are quite keen for them to go back to Scotland.
So, Jen, many people know about the destruction of the Scottish Highland culture and dismantling of the clan system following the Battle of Culloden. But something I wasn't aware of was the Highland clearances that you mentioned earlier, something which you've gone, I think, to to some lengths to explore in this book as a possible explanation for the loss or separation of some of the chess pieces. And you suggest that some may have ended up in Canada, in fact. I wondered if you could tell us a bit more about the clearances and why you wanted to explore this in the context of this novel.
I guess I was always aware of them, but it wasn't until I studied a bit more around Culloden for Vivaldi's Lost Concerto that I became even more aware. And then the more I read, the more horrified I came of how recent it's been and just the devastating impact that that has had on the people of the islands and the highlands mainly. The lowlands didn't suffer nearly as much. So, you know, like our Australian Aboriginal people, you know, their culture was taken from them, their language was taken from them, they weren't allowed to speak Gaelic, their music, you know, disappeared as along with people that disappeared. So it's had a big impact. I mean, of course, you know, in Australia we've been the beneficiaries of that in many ways, because, you know, so many of those Scottish people came here and set up wonderful communities here and brought with them their music. But people in Scotland still feel it very deeply. I've got a good friend who comes from Barra, one of the lower Hebridean islands. And yeah, she will still talk about her ancestors' involvement in that. And that's the story in their family. So yeah, still very real. You know, people can say it's a long time ago, but really, you know, it's only a few generations back and that carries through.
Grief. You talked about grief a little bit earlier, Mary Ann's grief for her father and other things. We aren't really just talking about a missing piece of the Lewis Chessmen. We're talking about, you know, the loss that Mary Ann feels, and something that she's been unwilling to acknowledge for most, for quite some time, for most of her adult life, in fact. Can you tell us how you got inside Mary Ann's head?
The word missing actually jumped out. I had a conversation with a friend who had a tragic loss in her family, and she said, "I just miss her. I'm just missing her." And that word, you know, like it just to me summed up, it kind of sidestepped all the horribleness and the anger and the dismay and shock and all of that to just get right to the essence of how she was feeling. So that helped me get into that. And I guess for any writer, they tap into their own, even the different types of loss and different types of grief. We tap into those feelings and then transfer them into our characters, into how that would be. And of course, you know, the tragic death of her father is one thing for Mary Ann, but also this other event. In earlier drafts of the novel, I actually kept that a secret right through the novel, but one of the big actual feedbacks was that really people guessed pretty early. So I thought, right, that's been brought forward. I won't name it here because I think it's nice for the reader to discover that as they go along. But I think, you know, that for me is, well, that experience, her experience is very close to another friend of mine who had that exact same experience when she was 16 or 17. So I guess I have been and had conversations with women who have gone through things where their sense of control was taken away from them and they had to make just hard decisions.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. And I think it really does colour, knowing that early on kind of colours our understanding of yes. Mary Ann and where Good. She's coming from. I think part of Mary Ann's journey as well is she also has the gift of second sight. I think it helps Mary Ann come to terms with her father's loss and decide the direction her life will be taking. Do you agree?
Absolutely. And I think, yeah, it's certainly a process. We see Mary Ann going through a process, and it is her dislodgement from the comfort of her job down in London, an extreme place. And I think extreme places do make people different. And certainly it had that impact on her and made her realise that she had to do things differently to allow goodness to come back into her life. I think that whole notion of learning and developing and journeying are there throughout all of the characters, but in particular, I suppose, we're closest to Mary Ann for longer. We really see that within her.
Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. Just quickly going back to Marianne's work, I was fascinated by the process of testing and handling artifacts within a museum setting. This was a terrific detail that you've included in this book. What helped you bring these details alive on the page?
I read stuff on the internet. I'm certainly not, it's not an area of work that I'm familiar with. So I just went to some archaeology textbooks, you know, fundamental textbooks, and, you know, watch stuff, you know, things on TV around this sort of stuff. So, look, and I think if it came under the scrutiny of an archaeologist who did this work, they would probably possibly find fault in it. But I didn't want that to be the focus, you know, of the whole thing. So I kind of thought this would be close enough to how things happened.
Jen, if there was one thing you'd like readers to take away from this novel, what would it be?
Yes, I've made some notes here because I knew you were going to ask me that. And my biggest one at the moment is enjoy the journey. I do, you know, sort of a message to my former self as well as to new writers is around, if you make being published and being published by the big publishers your only goal, you'll lose the enjoyment of everything else that you're going to do and achieve and learn about yourself along the way. And I think it can be a real trap. I see people falling into that trap often. So I would say enjoy the journey. Back yourself, you know, do what you can do to the best of your ability. And, yes, certainly try. Everybody wants to try to be published. There's no shame in that. That's what we all want. But enjoy the journey along the way, because you'll miss out on so much if you don't.
It kind of leads in well to my next question. And I was going to say, with two books under your belt now, a foot in each of the indie and traditional camps,
yep,
what do you know about yourself as a writer now that you wished you knew before you were published?
I think it's mostly about that I can do it, that I have got the skills to do it, and to be patient with myself about that journey, that you're not going to get it right first, second or third time, I know now that I can let go of things, and it's the whole killing your darlings thing. You do have to say goodbye to pieces of writing that you're really proud of and that you really enjoy, because they actually just don't quite fit in that plot, or that slows it down too much, etc. So, yeah, to be okay about doing that, and to know that I can get things finished if I really put my mind to it. Yeah.
Brilliant.
That's it.
Yep, fantastic. So what's next, Jen? Are you working on something else?
Yes, I've actually got my third novel, I'm calling Stolen, is completed. I've done lots of drafts. I've had lots of feedback from my wonderful writers group and a few other people about it. So whilst I'm in the promotion stage of Missing Pieces, I've put that on the back burner. I've put it in for a couple of competitions, but I haven't submitted it to any publishers yet. So that'll be the next thing. That's set in colonial South Australia, and it is set against the backdrop of the frontier wars. My next lot of energy will go into getting that moving and seeing where that goes.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Jen, if listeners wanted to learn more about you and your books, where can they find you?
I've got an author Facebook page and one just in my Jennifer McKenzie name. So both of those I'm quite active in terms of my work. Got a website that I'd love people to sign up to, because that's definitely my best way of keeping in contact with people. Not everybody's on Facebook, surprisingly. So, that's a good way for me to, and to cut through. Facebook is so busy with a whole lot of stuff. So I love it when people sign up to that. I use Instagram a little bit less probably than maybe I should. Yeah, the other three sort of main ways I think people can keep in contact with me and my work.
That's brilliant. Jen, I was delighted to have the chance to read Missing Pieces. I wanted to congratulate you on a truly fine novel. I wish you every success with it, and thank you for joining me on Talking Aussie Books again today.
Thanks, Claudine. It's been an absolute delight again.
That's a wrap, folks. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, please drop me a line via my webpage at claudinetonellis.com, via Instagram, Facebook or Twitter. Alternatively, consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. Until next time, happy reading!